Fast Eddie here in the studio with Steve Barber, a commemorative Air Force pilot who happens to be duly rated in not only the Grumman Hellcat, but also the Mitsubishi Zero. Hello, Steve.
How you doing, Fast Eddie?
Well, so far, so good. We're off to a little rough start, but we're getting it together. You know, this is very unusual, the fact that you're qualified to fly both of these aircraft. They were both bitter enemies in World War II. And, of course, when the war broke out, the Wildcat was the frontline fighter, and the Zero was superior to the Wildcat. And then, of course, around, I think it was late 1942, Grumman came out with the Hellcat, and the tide was turned. So what's it like to fly the Grumman Hellcat?
Well, the Hellcat is a typical Grumman airplane. The pilots used to call it Grumman Ironworks because it was overbuilt to a great extent. And one of the reasons it was so successful, it could absorb a lot of battle damage and still get the pilots back to the carrier. As far as flying, if you've flown an SNJ or an AT-6, it's a lot like an SNJ in that the handling, once you're in the air, is almost identical to it. The only thing different is you're going a lot faster and a lot more horsepower. And actually, the ground handling, takeoff and landing, is easier than an SNJ because of the wider track on the landing gear. So it's a great airplane to fly.
Now, what about the Japanese Zero? How is that when you want to land and take off?
Well, you know, the Japanese had the same issues we had. They were putting young pilots in the airplanes that didn't have a lot of experience. So the airplane was built so a junior pilot or a low-time pilot could handle it. Very wide track landing gear, nothing complicated on the systems. The most complex thing on that airplane, as far as I'm concerned, is the fuel system. There's 5 tanks in that airplane, and 2 of them hold 11 gallons. Another tank forward of the cockpit holds 17 gallons, and then the 2 wing tanks hold 50 gallons each. So the biggest trouble you have on a cross country, especially, is managing the fuel system, because it gets very quiet when the engine quits when it runs out of fuel.
Yeah, they do need a little bit of fuel once in a while to keep them in the air.
Yes, sir.
Now, one of the things that we were talking about earlier, do you ever do mock dog fights?
Absolutely. That's something we do at air shows all over the United States. And as I was telling you, the Zero usually loses unless we're in Japan doing the show. We have a smoke system on it. We have a choreographed routine in that the Hellcat's sitting on the runway after the Zero launches. The Zero makes a couple gunnery runs, and the Hellcat launches to intercept. And once we get the shoot down done, the Hellcat will come by with a victory roll at the end and land. So, yeah, we have a lot of fun with that.
What have you ever actually gone out and tried to do a dogfight for real? Without the ammunition, of course, but you get up there and just rack it around and see who can beat who?
Yes. The significant difference is the Zero will out-climb the Hellcat initially. It will out-accelerate the Hellcat initially, but the Zero has a really odd phenomenon, if you will. Once it gets to about 220 knots, it's like somebody throws a boat anchor out. It accelerates very quickly right up to that, and then it just slows down. I don't believe you could get 300 knots out of a Zero if you pointed it straight down with full power. It just, I don't know whether it's the wing design or what. Nobody's ever been able to give me the answer to that. So from the initial, it will outturn a Hellcat anytime. But once you're up to speed, the Hellcat will outmaneuver it and outclimb it and outrun it by a big margin. But at slower speeds, if the Japanese pilot could get the American pilot down to 150 to 175 knots, it was all in favor of the Japanese, which is why our pilots were instructed never try to dogfight with a Zero in a turning fight, because you would slow down too quickly and you'd be at their mercy.
Well, one of the favorite Japanese tricks was to actually do a vertical climb with a Wildcat pilot, and usually that didn't end well for the Wildcat pilot at all.
No.
And there was a Japanese ace who tried that with a Hellcat, and he did not have a good day.
Right.
Which is the easier to land?
I would say they're both equal. They land differently in that we tend to wheel land the Zero, and the reason for that is the weakest structure on the Japanese Zero is a tailwheel assembly. And so we don't like to beat it very hard with three-point landings, whereas the Grumman was designed to do a three-point landing on a carrier, and it really loves to do a three-point. The other thing with the Grumman, once the struts are compressed on landing, there's not a lot of propeller clearance between the runway and the propeller, so we tend to three-point them. And if you bounce a Hellcat on landing, you do not try to stick it like you would a Mustang or something. You'll get the propeller every time. So you just re-flare, re-land, add a little power if you need to, and that's how you land the Hellcat. It loves to three-point.
So in other words, it lands with a whump all the time.
Yeah, it's, if you do it right in the Hellcat, and you get the speed set up and you flare at the right altitude and it stalls at the time you want it to, it lands like a butterfly with sore feet.
Nice comparison.
Right.
What about the Japanese Zero? Well, first off, let's talk about landing speeds. Okay. How fast are you coming in with these aircraft?
Well, the Hellcat's a heavier airplane, number one. And assuming everything is okay, in other words, full flaps on the airplane, you will fly final at about 90 knots, over the fence at about 85. It'll land at about 75 knots. And you can slow down a little more, but it gets a little tricky. The Zero, we usually fly it at about 90 knots and about 85 over the fence. It'll touch down about 70.
So that's just a little bit faster than a Piper Tomahawk.
Right.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it handles very, very well. Both airplanes do. It is amazing. But again, they were both made to accommodate low-time pilots, and they made the handling qualities very good on both airplanes.
Well, you know, now talking about handling qualities, how about stick forces? How do they compare?
Unusual, the big difference. In the Hellcat, like a T6, the stick is almost like power steering. It never seems to really load up in any of the axis. Even at high speed on an aileron roll, the Hellcat rolls really easy. On the Zero, above 200 knots, both the ailerons and the elevator become very hard. And as a matter of fact, pulling out of a dive in a Zero, it takes a lot of force to pull that airplane out. And so that's the major difference. Whereas a Hellcat, you don't see much difference in it loading up at speed, but the Zero is really difficult. And this is one of the problems they had in dogfights with a Hellcat at high speed. The Hellcat could outturn them at high speed because the ailerons were not quite frozen, but 230 knots, it's a two-handed event to move that Zero with the ailerons.
That's wild. What about repairs and maintenance on these two aircraft? How does that all work out?
I think that is essentially like the airplane philosophy when they built them. The Hellcat is the Grumman Iron Works. They're overbuilt to such an extent that you don't have a lot of repair and maintenance on the airframe itself. On the Zero, it is made so lightly, we have found that a lot of things crack, a lot of things break. The cowl flaps are always a problem. Some of the other sheet metal on it, we have to rebuild occasionally. And again, the tail wheel, we have to rebush it quite often, maybe every year.
That's a lot of maintenance.
It is.
Well, the Japanese Zero was not known for its longevity anyway.
No.
Especially after the Hellcat showed up. Now, one of the other questions I have, what about maintenance manuals? Now, I'm sure you can get maintenance manuals for the Hellcat. Have you ever been able to get any paperwork on the Zero?
We actually, a Japanese national that was visiting us in our museum told us that he had a pilot's manual for the Zero and a maintenance manual from World War II. He delivered those to us, and one of our members, who is actually our crew chief on the Zero, is a Japanese national. He's now an American citizen. He translated all of the pertinent data from the original manuals to us. So we have a pilot's manual translated from the Japanese.
That's amazing.
It is.
You think that paperwork would have disappeared long ago. And of course, the Hellcat, you can get that paperwork just about anywhere.
Right.
Any reasonable aviation supply or a bookstore will have it.
Right.
That's kind of scary.
Well, while you were talking about the way the differences in the airplane, the structure on it, on the Hellcat, you can climb up on the wing and just about walk anywhere other than the gun bay doors without worrying about denting the aircraft. The Zero, not so. You have to be very careful how you climb up into the cockpit. They have several steps that pull out and handholds. And if you step off the wrong place, you're going to dent the sheet metal. That's how thin it is in comparison to the American airplanes.
Well, that was the project engineer. I forget the gentleman's name, but he went through the basic construction manuals and everything and rethought a lot of the Zero, which contributed to the lightness. Now, the Zero is built significantly different from the Hellcat. How do the constructions of both aircraft differ?
Well, as you and I discussed, Eddie, the The spar on the Zero is a one-piece spar, and it is riveted to the fuselage. So the only way you can break the airplane apart for shipping or transport is you can remove the empennage just aft of the cockpit, which is a big job, and take the engine off, but you're still left with the entire wing structure and the center section and cockpit. That's all one piece, so it's very hard to transport. Whereas the Hellcat, at the wing fold on both wings, you can take those wings off, you can actually take the tail feathers off, and get it down to a pretty slim size for transport.
So that was one of the major differences between them. Of course, the Hellcat was better armored than the Zero. What kind of armor did they have on the Hellcat?
Well, the Hellcat, of course, had armor plating behind the pilot. It had the bulletproof windscreen, which supposedly could take a direct hit with a 50 caliber round. And there was armor plate around important parts of the engine, like the oil tank. Whereas the Zero, the only piece of armor plate in the entire airplane was a very small piece of armor plate behind the pilot. That was it. The windscreen itself is about 3/8-inch plexiglass, and I don't think it would stop a BB. So they weren't very well armored. And on top of that, of course, we've all seen the pictures of the airplanes, the Japanese Zero, catching fire when it got hit. They had no self-sealing tanks, and therefore any strike in any of the fuel tanks on that airplane was pretty much disaster for the Japanese.
The airplane was built very light, and it couldn't really withstand a lot of combat damage then.
No, could not. And the other interesting thing about flying the Zero, when you sit in the cockpit, you will notice that you have the two 30 caliber machine guns. The charging handles are right in front of your face, so they had to reach up and pull the charging handles. And I just can't imagine how noisy and how smoky that was when that thing went off. There was a button on the throttle, on top of the throttle handle, and you'd slide it forward or aft. If you slid it forward, it would fire all four guns. It had two 20-millimeter cannons in the wings, the two 30-caliber machine guns. If you pulled the little handle back, it would only fire the machine guns. So,
so you could select the weapon you wanted.
You could select
the
weapon, right.
And the Grumman, of course, had just, what, 50?
Six 50-caliber machine guns.
And that packed quite a wallop.
Quite a wallop.
Well, the later models of the Hellcat, the Night Fighter version, eliminated two of the 50 cals and put 20-millimeter cannons in,
yes,
too. That had to be an impressive aircraft.
Yeah.
Which one do you prefer to fly?
Everybody asks me. I fly pretty much all the fighters. I love them all. I really, truly do. I think the real significant thing for us, the ones that are blessed enough to fly these, are the history behind it. You know, I think, like, I hop in the Zero to fly it, and I think that, you know, it was really the youth, the pride of their nation, the Japanese nation, that was flying these airplanes. Same with us, the pride of our nation flying our fighters. Really, they were flying for their country. So you have to think about what they went through and the horror of it all. And if they were lucky enough to survive, it's a tribute to them, is what I'm saying. Is we fly these airplanes as a tribute to the men and women that flew, maintained, and built these aircraft, regardless of the country of origin. So it's a real privilege and an honor for us to do that.
Have you ever met any actual Zero pilots?
Yes, sir. I was at an air show in San Diego, and a tour guide walked up, and she was the only one that spoke English, and she asked if I would mind talking to a couple Zero pilots. I didn't want to seem too excited, but I said, what do you mean, would I mind? I'd love to. And so through translators, we talked, and they were very, very humble and everything, very nice. And then they brought out one of their sons, who was dressed in a complete Zero pilot outfit. And he stood by the wing with these two older gentlemen. They took a lot of pictures. It was quite a moment.
Did they get to sit in the cockpit of the Zero?
One of them did. One was not ambulatory to do that, but the other one did, and the big smile on his face. You could see the years melt away as he sat in that airplane.
And, of course, you've run into a number of Hellcat pilots.
Oh, sure. They have some great stories, too.
Oh, I'm sure there are. Actually, I'm sure there are great stories on both sides.
I always remember the one from Jim McCoy, a Hellcat pilot. He was in the Battle of Midway, and as you know, a lot of those guys, they came back at night and landed. But the story I liked, he said he was on combat air patrol one day, and almost all the airplanes came back. He was the last one to land, and he went down. It was so hot, you know, out in the South Pacific. He got out of his flight gear in the ready room, went up to the buzzards row to watch, see if there's any other traffic. And Paddles brought in one last airplane. Paddles looked around, couldn't see anybody, so he started walking back to the bridge. And all of a sudden, he said, I started climbing down. He said, I saw paddles look up, run out to his platform, and stand with the paddles up. And he said, oh, another airplane. So here it comes. He said he was guiding him in. All of a sudden, paddles gave him the wave off, jumped over the side, and the paddles have a special area, roped area, where they could jump in case one's going to crash. And I said, what in the world? And he said, it was almost dark, and here comes a Japanese Zero going around.
Oh.
He said the meatball was right at my height going around. He said not one shot was fired by the Japanese pilot and not one shot from the carrier. And he said to this day, I don't know if the guy lost a bet if he didn't have the guts to approach an American carrier. He said probably he was just lost. The sun was setting and he was trying to land.
He was looking for home.
That's right.
That's wild. It's amazing the stories that come out of events like that.
You bet.
And of course, paddles, as you call them, the LSO, he had his hands full. There's plenty of footage out there of Hellcats not having the greatest of landings.
Right, and a lot of those boys were shot up and flight controls were compromised and they were wounded. So he had his hands full getting them aboard, notwithstanding they were probably terrified.
Yeah, and you know the conditions that you fly these aircraft under nowadays are significantly different from back then.
Yes, nobody's shooting at me.
Yeah, and that's a good thing.
That is a very good thing.
The sound of the Pratt & Whitney R2800 in the Hellcat, do you ever just crack the headphones a little bit and just listen to that while you're buzzing along?
Frankly, you don't have to because it comes through the helmet anyway, but I've had to on occasion when my mic has disconnected at the helmet. And on a climb, let me tell you, you do not want to do that. It is very loud.
The engine in the Hellcats, the R2800, easy to start.
Yeah, once you figure it out, and I teach the guys, the new pilots, how to do it. It's really quite simple. The main thing, you have to have the fuel boost pump on. Second thing is you have the mixture to idle cutoff, and you hit the starter, and we give it six blades. Turn the magneto on, and then hit the primer. There's a momentary switch primer. As long as you hold it up, it's priming the engine. It will start on the primer and run quite well. So we start it on the primer. Once it runs, we look at the oil pressure. Once that stabilizes, we pull the mixture control up to rich, and the engine will stumble at that point because it's very rich. You've got the mixture control forward and the boost pump. So as soon as it stumbles, we let go of the primer, runs like a sweetheart.
Beautiful. Sounds like fun. We've had a great conversation here with Steve Barber from the Commemorative Air Force, and you guys have a website, right?
Yes, sir. We have several. I'm with the Southern California Wing, and it's www.cafsocal.com. And then, of course, our home website, Midland, Texas, is caf.org.
Well, thank you, Steve. Appreciate you coming out. Have a great day here at AirVenture.
Thank you, Fast Eddie.